Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Weed Wongs, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the ever-changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, managing partner at VS Strategies. Thanks to our sponsors, Rootworks, who are helping make this podcast possible, as well as our amazing producer, Josh, who is joining us to make sure everything sounds absolutely excellent for all our wonderful listeners. Today, we have a very exciting show. Excited to do this. Feel like this has been in the works for some time. I've had the pleasure of getting to know our guest over probably about the last year, maybe a little bit more, dealing with cannabis policy in the great state of Maryland, a state that is very close to my heart, as we talked about on the last podcast with Mike. I am a proud University of Maryland graduate there for the great Juan Dixon years, where the University of Maryland won their NCAA championship, and I'm very happy about that. And I cannot be happier that my collegiate state, a state I spent many, many years in and a state that I have tremendous numbers of friends in, has moved forward with not just a medical program, but an amazing adult use program that's taken a lot of years to build up. And maybe it's one of those things where you put several years into something and the outcome is really exceptional. And so I'm incredibly excited to welcome Andrew Garrison to the podcast so we could talk about everything that's going on in Maryland today.
Hey, Jordan. Thanks for having me. We're excited to be here as well. And, you know, greetings from the great state of Maryland, America in miniature. And it's
America in miniature.
Yeah. I'm sure you heard that over the 4 years. It's one of the many taglines.
Yeah, it is, though, right? Like, I don't think people realize, like, how I think diverse the state is and how different it is and how different regions it is, and maybe even how the East Coast and the West Coast is like a little microcosm in Maryland, in the eastern and western parts of the state. So really cool. Definitely one of the things that makes politics in Maryland like uniquely interesting, because you have very liberal areas, you have very conservative areas, you have areas in between and in the middle, which, you know, in terms of public policy, typically balance between political ideologies is what creates the best public policy. And I think today we're going to talk about a lot of really cool things coming out of Maryland, what's happened recently, what happened in the legislation, the emergency rules that just came out, the almost about to start adult use market, which is probably going to be on the precipice by the time people hear this, and some initial regulations, and then all the future. But Andrew, it's your first time on the show. So why don't we start with how you got here? Because, you know, I'm guessing you had a life before the MMCC. Maybe you were born and woke up as a regulator out of the womb, but I'm guessing that probably didn't come that way.
No. Thank you. And you know, on certain days, it feels like I got here because I lost some sort of bet or something. But no, I have the pleasure of being the chief of the Office of Policy and Government Affairs now for the newly minted Maryland Cannabis Administration, which is another change that's happened since we last spoke, actually, since the bill signing, and in our new agency here. Prior to this, I've spent 4 legislative sessions as legislative staff with the Maryland General Assembly. Over there, my focus was actually largely on budget and healthcare budgets and health regulatory budgets in particular. So being involved in the regulatory space was, I think, a kind of a natural fit, because Maryland has this really unique healthcare pricing system and healthcare regulatory system that I was involved in during my time at the General Assembly, and really got a chance to understand what Maryland and what Maryland regulators have been up to. And then so really combining that experience with working directly with members made this a really interesting fit. And you know, there's very few opportunities in state government for someone who's been in state government and been in policy and politics in various ways for their entire career to have an opportunity like this. I also come from this with a little bit of a agricultural background understanding. Before I was in Maryland, I was actually in Texas, and I worked with the Food Bank Association and kind of doing anti-hunger advocacy work. But a lot of that intersects with ag policy. And so, you know, have a little bit of applied econ background, have a little bit of healthcare econ background. And a lot of that comes together in the cannabis space, mixing it in with working with elected officials in the legislature.
Yeah, I mean, that's like almost an ideal background for some of this stuff, right? Like, I think people are like, how do you get into this? And it's so unique and different. And I think the first lesson is it's not. right? It's just a commodity. The magic's in the plant, not in the rules. And to be able to understand agriculture, a very important part of the cannabis industry, to understand advocacy and advocacy for marginalized communities, which is a very important part of cannabis policy and cannabis reform, and then highly regulated industries. Having dealt with that in Texas, probably a very interesting place to be. As well as in Maryland, where it's, you were there, I guess, at the legislature for 4 years. And how long have you been at the, it's the, M, we're going to call it the MCA now?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Right now the MCA. It's been about a year, actually. So it's, feels like, you know, dog years at times, but about a year.
We all say that once you've been in cannabis for a long time, you've heard that joke for 100 times. I think I was at the ASTM conference here in Denver, and I had 3 other people tell me, been in cannabis for 4 years. It's like 16. And I'm like, yeah, man, this is year 11 for me. So it's certainly been a while, and I'm just a dinosaur that hasn't realized I've gone extinct yet, maybe.
I've been graying more quickly. I feel like since.
Yeah, I call them cannabis hairs. They're all over my face now, which I didn't have when this started. It might have something to be the difference between the early 30s and early 40s, but I'm going to blame it all on work and not getting older. And I love the fact that you guys are the MCA now, because as soon as you said that, like, they're immediately pinged a Lynyrd Skynyrd song in my head, working for the MCA, which I'm sure you guys, I would hope you guys are blared at the office on a regular basis, because that's a funny tongue-in-cheek song and probably perfect for you guys right now. Maybe you don't know that song, but you should go check it out after if you don't. And for those who are in Maryland, definitely think that's a funny one to listen to, maybe especially at this moment. It's really just been a year, right? But I think you've kind of gotten one of the more ultimate crash courses. It almost feels like mine, where I like walked into work one day and they're like, you're just in charge of implementing marijuana legalization. Because give or take, that's about what you walked into, right? It was, given the fact that it's about a year, probably just after the legislative session ended, it looks like we were going to a ballot initiative. And give or take, you had about 12 months to get from ballot initiative to legislative session to rules to sales. So do you feel like you're like a seasoned veteran, a wizened hand at this now, or are you still just drinking from the fire hose like the rest of us?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a ton to learn and still a lot to learn in the space. But what makes it so interesting is that it is a really constantly changing policy landscape. And so that allows me to, you know, think about it a lot and think really critically about it. And a lot of people, you know, our whole office has come from very different backgrounds. We have, you know, some folks from tobacco control originally. We have some folks from healthcare regulations. We have someone who works for me has a background in drug policy and overdose prevention. But all of those folks are able to learn cannabis because they're really smart individuals who are interested and curious about the space, and the space is constantly innovating. There's always ways to learn more. I by no means know everything there is to know about this. But, you know, our office, I think, really prides themselves on trying to be a resource for elected officials, for the public, for members of the General Assembly. And the only way we can do that is by being really knowledgeable as well. And yeah, like you said, when I started, we had yet to have the referendum, but we had a prior reform bill that sort of laid out that framework on a decriminalization front. So we knew what was coming. I think, you know, a lot of people expected the referendum to pass. And then from, you know, from that moment, we knew that we had a pretty tight timeline and a mandate to get a bill passed that would authorize adult use sales and then, you know, implement it in a really short period of time. And so that's where we are. That's where we're at now.
Yeah. And Maryland did really have that head start when you look, you know, at different states and timelines that have moved forward with adult use. Maryland was almost in a uniquely advantageous position to move quickly, because a lot of states, like, they don't start having real substantive discussions about what this should look like until it's like, okay, this bill is really going to pass. But I feel like in the several years leading up to this, even though a bill did not pass, there were significant, very substantive discussions about what it should look like. And even though those bills did not get across the finish line, there was a lot of meaningful dialogue that helped set Maryland up for success, right? It wasn't starting from ground zero. It was kind of like starting, I don't know, at the opposing team's 20-yard line, if you want to use a football analogy. If you don't, you can pick a new one. But I guess, you know, you kind of had a lot that you could pull from.
Yeah. And I really have to do, I think, credit the General Assembly and their leadership for, they had a cannabis worker that has been really active for at least 4 or 5 years now that I can think about it. And with that worker being the focus on legalization, you know, they went collectively to visit medical dispensaries or medical facilities in the state. They took a trip to Colorado even and like gone to like legalization states. And so there was a lot of thoughtful consideration that went into the broader adult use policy when it finally got dropped. And then in addition to that, you know, as you mentioned, Maryland is a really mature medical market that is going into adult use. There's 170,000 Marylanders already a part of the program. And so there is a history of us working on the regulations, of us making sure product testing is right, of the industry being, you know, familiar with our office and compliance that we're able to build off of that allows us to turn this on in, you know, the 82 days that we've been given by the legislature.
So Andrew, I just saw we had a quick special guest pop on the screen momentarily. What's your pup's name?
Yeah, so that is Fran. Her full name is Frances Scout Key, because we're coming here from South Baltimore. We're a mile from Fort McHenry, where the Stars family was run. So we named her after the neighborhood. She's a 10-month-old hound mix. She's adorable. We love her.
She is quite adorable. Unfortunately, our listeners can't see her, but I think they did hear her tail wagging while you were speaking the last time. So unfortunately, she got the boot out of the podcast room. But just so everybody knows that's listening, Andrew's dog is adorable. And the noise you heard when he was speaking the last time was his amazing dog wagging her tail. So obviously, this is a dog that's very in favor of really good cannabis policy and things moving forward, as well as cannabis policy podcasts. And so we appreciate her positivity and enthusiasm as we get started. So, all right, where were we? We were talking about how this idea of having a mature medical market and some of the work that the legislature had done. Not only did they come out to Colorado, but we had a really unique thing where the National Conference of State Legislatures was also in Colorado last year, which created almost like a subtle, unique opportunity for legislators who maybe didn't make the exploratory learning trip out or wanted to ask a couple of other questions. I know I got to chat with a bunch of different people about cannabis policy from Maryland while I was there. And most of those conversations were how do you make social equity work? And I think the answer is it's very hard. But we're going to keep trying. And I think that all of those things, the cannabis caucus, the trips to operating states, the ability to come to NCSL, the years and years of discussions put Maryland in such a uniquely advantageous place. It's going to be one of the fastest states to go from voter approval to sales. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of the cool stuff that's in the bill, but I want to just start with like, I could not have more tremendous kudos for the work that the people of Maryland did, that the legislature did in getting this bill across the finish line, and that the MCA's team has done, because there are not a lot of states that vote on an initiative in November and then open up sales that following July. Like, that's a very incredibly fast timeline, and the props are due without question.
Yeah, no, and, you know, we appreciate it. And yeah, like the referendum passed in November. But that just required or gave a mandate to the General Assembly to come back and actually figure out the framework. That framework bill wasn't passed until the last day of session on Sunday night. And from the day that bill passed to the first of July, when adult use sales are going to happen, we have 82 days from the day that bill was signed, which was sometime in mid-May, and essentially was effective, that we had the authority to start working on our regulations to put that stuff forward. To begin working with licensees about converting their licenses, which we'll talk a little bit more about too. From the bill signing on May 3rd to sales, it's going to be 37 days. And from that bill signing to when we had regs public for the industry to know how to, you know, be operating in this new market, we were able to put those on 16 days, calendar days, not business days, weekends, whatever. It was a really fast timeline. We did a lot of work, you know, with our team internally. We were able to pull in a bunch of the stakeholders, members of the General Assembly, the leadership, you know, everyone worked really hard to make sure that we were able to make sure we were all focused on that date and in that right direction. And that was a big piece and a big mandate from this, is that, you know, the voters in November said they want adult use sales to begin July 1, and then that's what the General Assembly did, and then that's what we did to help them meet that.
Yeah. When you say, 16 calendar days, not business days, I'm going to give a hunch that some atypical business day, some non-business days turned into business days for y'all. Cause you ain't getting regs done in 16 days if you're taking the weekend at the beach. I doubt there were some early season trips to Ocean City in that interim period for everybody to lounge and enjoy a drink, that's how it works, man. Like, that's government. I always got to tell people, like, it's sometimes it's quiet and sometimes it's crazy. And you frequently don't really even have control. You're just reactive. And you're like, all right, the next couple of weeks are going to be nuts. And then hopefully it'll be kind of chill. I don't think you're quite there yet. Probably going to take another six months or so for things to calm down. But there are two parts of the Maryland law, both coming from statute and the ethics and ethos and vision behind the statute and the initiative into the regulations that I think are really interesting to touch upon. Some things we've kind of sometimes seen before, some things with a unique spin. The two of them relate to patients, something obviously incredibly important in a mature medical market, that transition to adult use. You want to make sure patients are taken care of. And then social equity, which was absolutely at the forefront. Every time I talked to someone in Maryland, they were like, well, what we want to talk about is social equity. And I remember I even spoke to a pretty high up individual last summer. We spent, a half hour talking about social equity and what's worked in different states and what's worked in other industries, quite frankly, from an economic development perspective and all those things. And at the end, I was like, is there like literally anything else you want to ask me about? Like, I've been doing this long enough, pick my brain on any other topic that you care about. And he was like, no. I was like, that's it. That's like, we kind of figured out how to license people. We kind of figured out how to regulate it. We know what our facility regulations are going to be like. The thing that Maryland was still tackling in a lot of cases, there were other issues, but the real dilly of a pickle, if you will, was like, how are we going to structure social equity in a way that's effective, that meets consumers? And so why don't we start there? Why don't you talk about some of the social equity provisions that are baked into it and how you kind of looked at this from a, like, what were your North Stars as you were moving forward from statutory to implementation?
Yeah. And you're right that equity was a priority, and it's all over the bill. It's all over our regulations. You know, there's a lot of unique things that they did, but really one of the things first and foremost is the bill and the legislature created an Office of Social Equity that is nested within our office of the Maryland Cannabis Administration. Both my boss and the leadership at the Office of Social Equity are governor appointed positions. And that just like really shows the priority that the administration, the legislature has for making that position, the social equity piece, a really key component of everything going forward. You know, their office will be, it's an independent office within our entity. We're going to be supporting them in their mission, but they report to the governor, and they'll be able to work with my team as we're working on regs and the licensing round and making sure and keeping us accountable to those equity goals of the legislature.
So it's like in Colorado, we call that in, but not of. Like they're in the department, but they're not of the department. They're like kind of, I don't know. I always thought that was like an interesting way to frame it. It's like they're here in the office, but they technically report to somebody else.
Yeah. The statutory language is they are an independent office within the Maryland Cannabis Administration, which is not a phrase I've seen often throughout Maryland code otherwise. So that's a really interesting component of this. And from that office flows some of the social equity provisions, but a lot of it is also work that we're doing. So one of the items that's going to that's really front loaded in this is the application round. The application round being initially just reserved for the social equity applicants, and then that's something that I think builds off of and learns from what has worked in other states when contemplating social equity licensing rounds. And so that's our first round. And then even within that application round, so not only are we setting aside this first tranche of licenses just for the social equity applicants, there's also different license classes and types that the state has created that perhaps present themselves more so for a social equity applicant because it might have a lower capital barrier to entry. So there's a whole tranche of micro licenses. So along the grower process dispensary, there's explicitly smaller licenses that are envisioned to be less capital intensive to operate. They have reduced application fees. They'll have reduced licensing fees, licensing and renewal fees. And then even within that, once we have these micro licenses, the legislature's also created a what they're calling an incubator space that allows these micro licenses to work and share a location. So even though they're already smaller operations, they're going to be less capital intensive. they are actually even further going to be assisted by having a sort of shared commercial real estate opportunity that they can all kind of partner into. They can share a commercial kitchen if they're microprocessors and all use that. They can share storage facilities and have secure storage on site. And not only do these incubator spaces exist as a way to potentially help and streamline getting these businesses online, the first incubator space is going to be built by the Maryland Economic Development Corporation and then owned by the Department of General Services, so being entirely state supported, will even, you know, A, help get this business model online for the incubators, but then also have whoever is in control of that incubator have a lower cost to entry themselves. So then they're not charging higher rents, those micro licenses. And so that's really just on the new license types and the new businesses. Additionally, the existing businesses have some restrictions put on them to make sure that once these social equity licenses are coming online, they're doing business with them as well. So there's requirements for the social equity applicants to have at the dispensary 25% of the shelf space is either with the social equity applicant or one that doesn't share common ownership. And so when these social equity businesses are being started, the dispensaries will have to be stocking their products to make sure that we don't have just vertically integrated firms just selling their products, continuing, you know, to make sure that there's a path to market for these non-vertically integrated firms. And then that also continues back up the supply chain as well. So there was concern about growers only giving their, you know, flower to certain processors that they like working with, but that's also something that will be, that they'll be required to distribute certain amounts to those social equity businesses once those come online. And then I feel like there's more I'm forgetting them too.
All right. Well, let's just take a pause because there's so much to unpack there that what we don't want to do is kind of go through so many of these different components that we lose track of some of them, because I think some of them we've seen before and are important. Some of them are different flavors and versions of things that I really want to hit on, like the state funding the incubator facility. And then some of them are, you know, unique, what I would call efforts to ensure market access without aggressive market manipulation, which, you know, is kind of my favorite version of these things, which is, you know, we're not trying to control the market. We're trying to help people be successful. We're trying to prop folks up as opposed to tamp them down. And so let's just start at the very beginning, because at the outset, Maryland is doing something that I think is really unique and important. And that is, sales are coming on July 1. Obviously, new social equity businesses are not being licensed and opening their doors July 1. The existing operators are going to be allowed to open. And that's important for a variety of reasons, but also gives you guys a leg up on funding in terms of the conversion fees. So why don't we start like the decisions around that, the North Stars that guide some of this, and what are those conversion fees and why is that kind of so important that we're going to balance, I guess I'm going to steal a little bit of your thunder, but balance access with equity.
Yeah, for sure. So this was said on the floor, in the House floor for the bill, and it's something that we've talked a lot about, and we'll touch on each of these a little bit more. But it's safety. You know, we know we have a robust medical program. We know that, you know, the testing and the processing that we've done up until this point, you know, produces a safe product for folks. It's access that is both for the voters, you know, the people of Maryland who voted overwhelmingly for this, two-thirds of the state overall supported, over two-thirds, every jurisdiction but one. And then again, equity, which, you know, we'll talk about, but, and we've been talking about, but the balancing all of those, as we get to market has been really important for us. And so how access and equity fit together is through those conversion fees, like you mentioned. So because we have this, you know, existing medical market, they really are the starting point for the program in the legislation as it's being considered. But in order to get there, you have to convert your license into this new license that's being created. And the way to do that is to pay a fee based on how much money you made in calendar 2022. And that money doesn't go to us or my office. It goes to a fund that was created by the General Assembly, which is the Community Reinvestment and Repair Fund. And that money specifically goes to local jurisdictions that have communities in them that have been disproportionately impacted by cannabis prohibition. There's a formula as to how that's figured out that will ultimately be, again, something that the Office of Social Equity determines. But it's going to places where there's been disproportionate cannabis arrests in the state. And it's a lot of money that's going to be going to them. Our most recent estimate is that's going to be about $60 million. conversion fees that will be going into that fund and will be distributed to those communities in the state that really do need it. Because, you know, as I mentioned at the top, Maryland's a really diverse state. And there's a lot of communities in particular that, you know, Baltimore City is certainly one of them that have had disproportionate cannabis enforcement really up until this point. And we want to make sure that the folks who are getting access to this market, access on the market side early before these social businesses come online, are, you know, that the legislature wanted to make sure that they paid their dues and that it goes to the communities that were at the most disadvantaged by the previous, you know, 10, 15, 20, however many years.
100 and change, yeah, depending on how you want to count it. But
I think it's only 20 in statute, but yes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that's just such an important way to think about things, right? There are Marylanders who voted for this that said, we want access to regulated, safe products, right? Safety is important. The regulated market provides far safer products than the illicit market. We've got lots of evidence and about that. And so we want to make sure we are prioritizing safety. We are prioritizing access. We're talking about access among general adult consumers. But pause a minute. We're also prioritizing access for patients, a very important group of people who should have access. But we're not ignoring equity at the outset. We're saying, okay, hey, we're going to make sure we get to access in a very timely manner. And we're going to make sure that promotes public health and safety. But at the same time, we are going to make darn sure that even that quick access has a equity benefiting component to it through these kind of conversion fees. Okay, so that's step one. We've got our three North Stars: safety, equity, and access. The second one is initial licenses that you talked about. All the initial licenses are actually reserved for social equity applicants, right? And this has been a big deal in Maryland. I remember the first time I talked to somebody in Maryland about this. I forget the name of the legislator and their staffer that reached out. It was right after the initial round of licenses had come out, and they were disappointed about the distribution of licenses. And I don't think they got an answer they liked from me, which was largely like, what did you think was going to happen? And you know, look, we all learned new lessons. I think the outcome there, people were frustrated with. And we've created a new version, and we've taken something totally different and flipped it on its head and said, okay, we understand we got to care about access. We have to care about some of the other things, but we are going to make darn sure that these initial rounds of licenses go to the people harmed by the war on drugs, the communities harmed by the war on drugs. And so you have special licenses, which you talked about, special license classes, special license fees, and that whole first round of really cultivation licenses, controls on the amount the initial people can grow. So you're trying to do your best to create space within the market at the outset at the production level. But then really importantly, you talked about the incubator, and the incubator is something that's really close to my heart, because we worked a lot on an incubator program in Colorado and it hasn't really materialized. In fact, we were lamenting about a week ago internally in Colorado in some policy meetings about the lack of incubation that's actually occurred within our accelerator program. They were upset. And I was like, yeah, but there's literally no incentive to participate in the program. And I told them before, and I'll tell them again, like, I have a friend of mine that runs a cannabis business here that is literally incubating somebody who qualifies for social equity and didn't join the accelerator program because they're already doing the thing. They don't need approval for it. And the only thing the accelerator program benefited was additional government oversight. So, you know, hey, if you want extra government oversight, you can join the program. If you just want to incubate somebody, you can do it anyway. Maryland took a different approach. And the approach that I think is most fascinating is you're actually funding the first. That's amazing that you're actually going to take public dollars and invest them into this facility, which, you know, is kind of critical, right? Like, everyone asks me, how do we fix social equity in Colorado? And I'm like, we've been one philanthropic billionaire short for 11 years. So as soon as you track that philanthropic billionaire down, social equity will be kicking butt and taking names in a lot of ways, because they can fund that facility, right? They can build that incubator facility. The philanthropic billionaire in the state of Maryland happens to be the state of Maryland, which actually has access to this capital, prioritized this. And that's really cool, because a lot of times you don't always see legislatures prioritizing this in terms of their tax revenues. This is not some cheap thing. $60 million for locals, and they're also investing in building out a facility to help support these brands get off the ground, because access to capital and barriers to entry are probably some of the biggest problems. And so how did that come about? What do you think that's going to look like? I mean, that's probably, like, you know, we're talking about building a facility, so it's probably not going to open tomorrow. But just a little bit of insight as to the thinking and what you expect to see over time, not that we're holding you to any of these best guesses.
Yeah. And I think what's been a theme that we've seen in the new administration with our legislative leaders, but really on the administration level, which obviously changed in November and the new year as well, is the ability to sort of just like let regulators regulate. Like my office, our job is regulating the licensed market. We don't do economic development. So what the legislature did is they gave it to the Maryland Economic Development Corporation. Like they're the pros at this. And like I had a meeting with them and I said, hey guys, like here's kind of like what the concept is. You go figure it out. And like they made a survey, sent to the local economic development boards. Like when the economic development person has a question, she calls or emails me. But then otherwise, like they're doing it. And then once they've developed it, it goes to the Department of General Services, which is the state entity that owns and manages buildings. Like we don't get to own it as the administration because like we don't have leases. General Services does.
And that's just so important, right? I just want to pause right there because I want to get into the other stuff, but like pause. Cannabis is a widget. It is just another commodity. It's an awesome one, but it's still just another commodity. And a lot of states make the mistake of like trying to invent new solutions or do things differently. And you guys were like, no, we know how to do this. Cannabis isn't different. It's like any other thing. And we have people in our state who are experts in getting these kinds of things off the ground and making these things a reality. So we're not going to make the MCA do something that they're inherently swimming upstream. We're just going to give it to the people who know how to do this. And I think that that sets you up for success in a great, great way. So anyway, continue. I think that's such an important piece and component to this, and I want to make sure it gets highlighted.
Yeah. And another example, and if you want to talk about, again, public investment, the Cannabis Business Assistance Fund has received $40 million in the last two fiscal years, or fiscal 23 and fiscal 24 forthcoming, $80 million total. That's going to get businesses up and running, give people technical assistance and licensing, help out these social equity folks, help out existing businesses who are, you know, still struggling to become operational, who are from a kind of previous licensing round. And that fund is, again, not us. That's the Department of Commerce, who gives out grants and loans to businesses. And that is, again, another example of both the state and the legislature investing public dollars into this to making sure this works, but then also the administration making sure that everyone's kind of rowing in the same direction. And if you have the governor's administration, not just our little administration, but making sure that everyone has, that has their own piece in this and is doing their job that their office and their unit is specialized at. And that's made a really collaborative effort throughout, you know, kind of the various cannabis policy landscapes and people who have the little bits and pieces throughout the rest of state government. Yeah.
Cross collaboration, not forcing people to do things they're not an expert in, right? Good philosophy of governance. Kudos to Maryland once again. That's probably going to be a theme. All right. So we have access prioritized. We have access leveraged for conversion fees, helping out local governments who have been harmed by the war on drugs. We have initial licenses reserved for social equity. We have the state investing in its own incubator facility, not hoping someone comes along and does this, which probably isn't going to happen. So kudos on that one. And then we're going to get to my favorite stuff, something that's, I think, somewhat unique and interesting. We've seen incentive programs in Oakland that I've talked about a few times. And we had the Hood Incubator folks talking pre-pandemic a while back about how they've done this in Oakland. But you have, it's slightly different. It's not an incentive. It's a mandate. We'll see how all this stuff plays out over time in regs. But the bottom line is it is a market-based solution. It is not, it is not a control the market solution. It is a, we want to make sure that this part of the market is prioritized and has access to consumers. And that involves 10% of yield from cultivation facilities need to be sent to social equity processors. Really important. Can't be a processor if you don't have biomass. So kind of critical. And then shelf space, because at the end of the day, consumers are king always, and the consumers need to know about social equity products. They need to have access, and you are reserving shelf space for them. So can you talk a little bit more? I know that wasn't part of the initial regs. You can't have it as part of the initial regs because you can't reserve 25% of shelf space for people who haven't been licensed yet, but that will be forthcoming. And so where do you see that over time, like, how do you see that playing out? What are some of the details that you're thinking about? Because it's such a great way to think about how we support equity as we move forward.
Yeah. And this is actually, and I'll back up just a little bit and kind of a little, you know, inside baseball kind of nerdy piece of legislative politics of this. Our previous commission and entity was over in Health General because we were a medical program, right? So we were dealing with the health subcommittees. And what happened this session is, you know, we became into the business reg subcommittee. We actually, everything got actually recodified into the alcoholic beverages and cannabis article. So there's a lot of pieces that are borrowed from alcohol regulation, frankly, in various ways, including, you know, what is known in the alcohol industry as trade practices, you know, that you can't, you know, there's certain restrictions on what displays you can have, or like, there's a reason no one goes into a Budweiser bar because that's against the kind of standard alcohol trade practices. So, that sort of idea was I think borrowed and put into this aspect of policy where you can't just sell one product, right? It has to be, you know, common. It has to be from someone who doesn't share a common ownership with you. And then, so we're layering on top of that over time that the social equity piece of it will take over more. So at the dispensary level, what we want you to do is diversify your product line, even, you know, starting from day one to other folks who don't have the same ownership, you know, control structure as you, not an entirely vertically integrated firm, not someone, you know, who's just selling their products all the way through. And then as those social equity businesses start coming online, it's obviously it would be unreasonable for the state to expect the very first social equity business to produce enough product to be in 25% of every single dispensary in the state. But as right. those businesses grow, as more of them come online, to then be eating at that uncommon ownership one. So we are already having product diversity, but then replacing that product diversity with the social equity products, which will also inherently be from someone who doesn't have common ownership with you because they're a newly licensed individual.
Yeah. And I don't want to say eating up because sure. eating yeah, up, yeah. I think it's supplementing, right? Yes. And adding, because what's going to happen is those third-party products that were originally on the market, as more of that percentage needs to be social equity, the store is going to be incentivized to retain a lot of those other third-party products. Because again, the consumer is king. And if you're running a store and people are coming in and saying, no, I want the, you know, Wana brand gummies, you're not just going to stop carrying them, even though you have to carry a social equity brand, right? You still need to meet your consumers. And so that's a really cool thing, right? Because I think what you're talking about is saying, hey, we're looking at alcohol, a relevant and similar commodity. We're seeing how it's regulated. We understand the ethos, the vision behind those things, but you're not copying and pasting them. It's not a three-tier system, right? It's not that. It's saying, okay, we understand the goals. We understand the policy levers they're pulling. How do we create something similar for cannabis? We're not a copy and paste. And that's really cool too, because it's much easier to copy and paste. It's much harder to look at something, understand why, understand the reasons, understand where it's coming from, take a step back, then think about how to apply it in a different market, in a different vertical. And that's how you create great policies, is you take lessons learned, but you don't copy and paste. You learn those lessons for real. You absorb them, and then you apply those new lessons. So
and that is a good and important correction, is that it's not, you know, it is by having diversity on the shelf spaces, by having diversity of where the products are going, you know, there's going to be more potentially consumer demand down the road for those. And so while the requirement is 25% and that, you know, is replaced and supplemented, you know, we're not necessarily saying mandating what has to be on half the shelves of the dispensaries. But I think one would reasonably anticipate that as consumers get used to more products and they want to be having those on the shelves, there will just be inherently more diversity around the shelves in Maryland dispensaries.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's exactly it. Yeah. No, I wasn't trying to correct you. I was like highlighting how cool it is. Like I, you know, cause I, you know, for whatever reason was born a policy and process nerd. And I love not just like the outcomes, but the theory of how we get there, because that's where we can learn to be better and better and better. So, all right. So the second thing, and then I want to talk about this for a minute. And then I know we're coming up on the 5 o'clock hour for you guys in Maryland, and you've had a long run. So I'm guessing, probably a quiet evening is in your future with some relaxation. But I do want to talk a little bit about patient access. And then I think you know, we definitely need to talk about the future, because as cool as what's going on now is, I think there's some really exciting stuff in the future that we definitely want to kind of hit on too, especially my favorite topic. But first, let's talk a little bit about patient access, because there's some piece to this that you guys have done that said, okay, cool. When we are prioritizing safety, access, and equity, patients have to be at the center of that circle. And if you are prioritizing health, access, and equity, you have to be prioritizing patients. And if you're talking about prioritizing safety, patient safety is obviously incredibly important. Patient safety requires patient access. And you cannot think about equity solely in terms of like who's been harmed by the war on drugs, because there's lots of people that have harmed by the war on drugs, including sick people who didn't have access to medicine, right? So that is a core component to all three of those tenets. So what is Maryland doing to ensure that although we definitely want to prioritize access for all adults, we can't forget about patients in our march towards progress?
Yeah, and you know, now I feel like I've said this a handful of times, but this is a very mature medical market. There are a lot of Marylanders who have had a product and a process and an understanding of our office and of how they can get their products and how they can be registered with us for going on 5 years now. And one thing the legislature is really intentional about, we were really intentional about in our regs, is not disrupting that for those folks. And in fact, really making sure that when, you know, the other, whatever, 4 million Marylanders have access to this in 25 days from the time we're recording this, less than that, the dispensaries are still allowing for those folks to have access to those products that they've relied on kind of over the last, you know, several years. So one of the things is at a baseline level, a dispensary has to either have patient-only hours, so time for only the patients to come in. It has to be the same hours every day if that's the route they're going. They can't just say, like, you know, it's 7 a.m. one time and then it's 7 p.m. the next time. And it has to be consistent to make sure that, again, folks can have plan their day around that. Or they have to have a dedicated service lane for them. So a fast lane is what it was called, right? Like, this is the patient register. And this is where they can go. And so they can move through a lot more quickly, especially as I think we anticipate some long lines here in the early summer. Additionally, the dispensaries are required to reserve products for patients. And so, and this is an interesting piece that Maryland's also doing is, you know, while patient access really is in the forefront, the supply chain is staying the same. We're not having medical plants and adult use plants. It's really going down to the point of sale.
Sorry, I probably didn't help the audio that I was just clapping in the middle of it. But as someone who lives in a state where you have literally, like, we've been dealing with this problem forever, at different colored metric tags, like, yep, cannabis plants, yep, are cannabis plants. Like, we have to stop, like, it's just adds layers of unnecessary. So anyway, sorry, very excited about that. Probably one of the few people in the world that's excited about combining plant tracking. But yeah, I will count myself among those nerds. All right, back to the actual real stuff.
No. So with that being in mind, that all of the products are flowing through the supply chain, the differentiation has to happen at the point of sale between medical and adult use. And obviously there's, you know, tax implications of either. But in order to reserve products for that, you know, we get into a kind of a bit of a market conversation, right? Like, how much do we want to be controlling? Like, there's in order to meet the legislature's mandate, you know, do you say you can't sell out, right? Like, you have to always stock 10%. Like, that feels onerous. And so what we elected to do instead in regs is have certain products be set aside just for medical consumers and for the medical patients. And so that is, in this initial round of regulations, concentrated products. And so concentrated products are definitionally a, you know, higher potency, something that the medical consumers have been able to have access to. Additionally, edible products or liquid edibles or tinctures or capsules or anything that's over 10 milligrams per serving, 100 milligrams per package, that's also kicked into that medical category. So again, looking at who can access these products, and that will, given the makeup of what's on shelves right now, already make this automatic set aside for stuff that medical patients have been used to buying, and they're the only ones who they can buy, who can buy those. And so I think that's going to be a really interesting way to make sure that those folks are still getting access to what they need once everyone else is also able to go to the dispensary doors.
Yeah. And all of this is subject to change. I don't want to say it will change, but all of this is subject to change, and we will see how that works over time. So let's talk about where we're at or where the future is, right? So we passed an initiative, passed a bill, got our initial regulations out in record time, going to sales very shortly in record time. But to do things in record time means that there's probably a little bit more tinkering down the line coming than a state that took 2 years or 3 years from passage of initiative to start sales, or even 9 months instead of, you know, I mean, I think in Colorado, we passed in November and started sales the following January. So we had an extra 6 months, and that 6 months leads to more market development, more policy making, and all of those things. Now we're in a space where you don't have to, you kind of got everything out. You've got your initial set done, and it's almost like, okay, we're going to take a deep breath. And then once we've done that, we're going to roll up our sleeves. And so what does rolling up your sleeves mean in terms of, why don't we start out with timeline, but I also really want to talk about stakeholder engagement, because obviously that's the best way to make great regulations and policy.
Yeah. So, again, I guess like now a little bit of like admin law, which is boring for anyone who doesn't listen to this podcast, but the regulations that we put out are emergency regulations, which generally in Maryland are only good for 6 months. We actually got a exception in the statute to allow them to be good for a year. So that's, so we have the regulations that my office and we all put out a couple of weeks ago will be effective July 1st. And in statute, they will be good until July 1 of 24. So we have, that starts a 12-month clock for us to start working on those. And while it is a really dense document, what we did a lot of times is we just reference back to our old regulations. And so it's 41 pages. If I included all of my cross references, it'd probably be 250 pages. And so the first step is going to be looking at that old stuff that we referenced that we frankly didn't think too hard about, meeting about it internally, meeting with external stakeholders, you know, meeting with the industry folks, say, what about the old regulations that have, you know, been kind of annoying or a roadblock or something we can streamline? Making sure that when we then recodify those back into our permanent regs, we're making those fixes that people want. And then obviously there is a decent amount of new stuff in that new regulatory package. Looking at after implementation, how has that worked in Maryland, right? You know, there's a few, you know, assumptions that we had to make based on what other states have done, based on, you know, what our, you know, kind of other state partners think was the best idea. But that might not be the case in practice. You know, is something a little bit harder to implement? Do we have to, you know, tweak some of those proposals already? And that's again going to be the conversation once those are in effect with the folks, you know, operating in the state. And then, you know, we would anticipate, because we need to go through a normal regulatory process sometime during next legislative session, putting those, that full permanent regulatory package out, giving them the time to go through the full notice and comment and admin law period. While probably we're also working on a cleanup bill, because, you know, it's a 113 page bill too. And I've read it a lot. I have most of it memorized, and there's even some stuff that I missed during the session. And I was like, shoot, that doesn't make sense here. They should expand this. And so, seeing what gets changed next legislative session, is another piece. And the General Assembly is obviously a big stakeholder of ours, as well. And, you know, because they're a real conduit for public opinion and making sure that what we did in the emergency round is reflective of what the people want. And if they are making substantive tweaks to the statute, that obviously needs to flow through our regulatory structure as well.
Yeah. So from a timeline perspective, and then I want to talk a little bit about stakeholder engagement, and then probably that's good for now. And we can touch back in and probably the next few months, I'll bug you to come back on, and we'll probably be doing this once or twice again. But so for starters, rules effective July 1, probably a well-deserved deep breath for an undetermined period of time, or an unknown period of time, at least on my end. You guys probably have a sense of how long you get to breathe for. And then you have a variety of work streams that may occur in parallel, essentially. First work stream, looking at what we did in medical that we just carried forward and trying to figure out how to make that more efficient. Second work stream, stuff that was not implemented in the emergency regulations, but needs to be implemented from the bill. Third work stream, hey, we put this stuff out there. We're probably going to learn some lessons. almost guaranteed the emergency regulations affect July 1. Ain't going to be perfect in reality. So you're going to have to make some tweaks there. And then, of course, as always with large legislation, there is probably going to be a trailer bill. And as always with cannabis policy in most states, not all, like Massachusetts, maybe not as much, there's ongoing tinkering. So whether it's a trailer bill or a new brilliant idea that no one had thought of last year but thought of this year, or a brilliant idea that didn't quite make it to the finish line last year, one way or another, you're going to be dealing with statutory changes. So I count four work streams over the next 12 months that you're going to need to work through. And when you do have four work streams that you need to get through, the best way to get to the other side with the best public policy is stakeholder engagement. So how do you see engagement with stakeholders, whether that be working groups, meetings, all of the things that are going to go into coming out July 1, 2024 with even better, more comprehensive, more effective, even more awesome regulations than you currently have now?
Yeah. So I think the first step is obviously a really robust internal review, and you know, our deep breath is going to be short because probably the, you know, second week of July, myself and my staff are going to be focusing our effort on really combing through the old medical regs, right? And then I think from there, we'll have sort of a jumping off point as a conversation for those industry groups and those other stakeholders. And so we anticipate that being phased in kind of by the different interested parties. So the growers and the processors in the state, frankly, had less new stuff than our dispensaries do. A lot of the changes that we're doing are happening at the dispensary level. They're the ones who are really the most impacted by adult use sales, given the single supply stream that we've talked about. And so, you know, we're able to, you know, probably talk to the growers a little bit sooner, you know, I'm just going to say dates, you know, August, September-ish. Whereas with the dispensaries, we might want to give them a little bit more time to work through what's actually happening on the ground, you know, talk to them maybe later fall. We've described it as internally as limited town halls, so like little groups that have, you know, a similar interest. And then on, you know, an additional party, again, that we want to make sure is working is this patient access piece. So we have patient advocates in the state, as most states do, and making sure that what we thought, you know, made sense in the bill and in regulations around patient accommodations and the access to products is actually manifesting itself to make sure that they're able to get the products that they need. And so those are kind of the three cohorts that we've talked about reaching out to, you know, that we've, you know, I have in my office on my whiteboard a sketch of every single chapter of regs and which one of those groups I want to talk to about that. And just like I went through with my staff and I just put check boxes next to all of them. And so that's going to be, you know, a fun late summer, early fall activity. And then, you know, unlike the emergency regs, if those individuals don't necessarily get everything they want, there is a notice and comment period because of the permanent regulation. So
gotta love formal rulemaking. Yeah. You know, almost feels like you do stuff twice sometimes. You know, you go through stakeholder engagement before you put out your draft regs to make sure you don't have a mutiny on your hands. And then you go through the formal process and you have more and more tweaks over time. But one of the realities of government processes, the arduousness of it tends to lead to good results. So we can dog out how frustrating it can be, but it's hard to dog out the outcome sometimes because that's how you get to great stuff. So right now we've got stakeholder engagement planned through the fall, through the end of summer, through fall, probably up until legislative session. And then you're going to have to go through the formal rulemaking process to make sure rules are effective and do all of that. And you talked about limited town halls, but the legislature in and of itself is like a limited town hall in a way. So you're going to have town halls going on with elected officials as they work through whatever changes they want to make. And eventually you will come up with the permanent regulations July 1, 2024. And when we say permanent, you're just going to retire and go out to pasture and rest on your laurels and be sipping cocktails with umbrellas in the Caribbean, because I'm sure that once July 1, 2024 happens, Maryland's regs will be perfect for perpetuity and we won't be back making changes again within the next few months.
I mean, while that won't necessarily be the case, I will say I have like circled July 1, 2024 in my head as like the next time I can get a meaningful vacation in. I was very fortunate to actually be able to go on my honeymoon in the immediate post session period, but that was probably the last long time away from work I'm going to spend in a while.
Where did you go? I guess Just out of curiosity.
We were in South Africa and Mozambique for 2 weeks.
Wow.
That lovely.
That's awesome. Great Bob Dylan song about Mozambique.
Yeah, that's another one I'm not going to know, man. I'm sorry. Yeah,
it's okay. Everybody will leave with something to hit up on their Spotify.
But yeah, but I think, and this is, a very nerdy plug from a rulemaking perspective, but because we are our own independent state agency, we're expecting our regulatory process to be as nimble as possible, given the administrative law restrictions there. Whereas previously we were, a commission that was tucked within the health department. So we had three additional layers of bureaucracy to go into. Now we really just have one, and it's that rulemaking process. And so we think that, while we hope to get it perfect by July 1, 2024, knowing that won't necessarily be the case, I think we'll be able to move rules and adjustments a lot more quickly as policy continues to change.
Yeah. Well, if you guys get the perfect on July 1, 2024, you will be the first government agency in the history of government agencies in any issue area to get something perfect. Perfect is an elusive mistress at the least in policy. It is a constant quest for self-improvement. So I think that's a perfect place to rest, right? We've got an amazing, I just can't give you guys enough kudos for the work that's been done so far. Record breakneck pace. To get from initiative to actual sales and access for Marylanders, prioritization of equity, prioritization of patients, prioritization of safety, both public health and safety, as well as health access for patients. And that's really, really cool policy ideas that hopefully will work out perfectly and maybe not, but that's what we're all here for, is to learn and make it better over time. And really looking forward to not just seeing what happens over the next couple of months, but rolling up our sleeves together and continuing to support the MCA as it continues to make some great policy along the way. And I'll make sure next time we get on a podcast or I see you, I'll come up with some other song recommendations for you as well. So Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time at the end of a long week.
No, again, thank you for having me. This was a pleasure and the nicest anyone's been to me this week. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure I'm creating some balance with some people I wasn't nice to earlier in the week in my life, as all things should end on a Friday afternoon balance. So thank you so much. Can't wait to hear more about the great stuff coming out of Maryland. And with that, stay nerdy, everybody.